There will be spoilers ahead. Lots of spoilers, so be careful, won't you?
Gosh, it's hot. It's so hot. It's so hot.
How hot is it?
I saw a funeral procession pull through a Dairy Queen. It's so hot.
How hot is it?
Cows are giving evaporated milk. It is so hot.
How hot is it?
I saw a chicken lay an omelet. Oh, today is going to be a scorcher. Ooh, that's for sure. Warm? We'd have to step into the freezer just to get warm. Man, oh man alive. Have I mentioned the weather? It's not just tempers that are going to flare. Let me tell you. When old man Fahrenheit stops his climbing, he is just gonna fall down and pant because he's so tired of climbing because of the heatness of being hot. Well, I was going to be here all week, tip your waitstaff, but it seems that I have to get off the stage and make room for Max Mike Movies.
Thank God.
Who wants to listen to those bums? Oh, wait, I am one of those bums, but not the main one. That would be Max Main Bum Levine. Give us a toot, Max.
I get to be the main bum this week? Yes!
Yeah, like every week. Me? Heck, I'm just Mike, assistant bum loose. And you can guess what's coming out of movie today is 1989's Do the Right Thing, a movie which didn't win the Best Picture Oscar for that year. And that's what our series is about, too. Thing is, it didn't win because it wasn't even nominated. A lot of people think that just maybe it should have been, especially one of our listeners, Keith Wright. And was he right? Well, there's only one way we're going to find out. But before we can even think about that, we gotta think about the
poll question.
Last week, inexplicably, we wanted to know what your favorite performance by Michael Cera was. And
because we hate ourselves.
And you, just as inexplicably, had answers. Because it's so hot, we're going to start at the website where Vince, King of All Canada, has written us a cool response.
Ooh.
Quote, I have never really seen Michael Cera in anything except at our monthly secret Canadian meeting where we dine on seal blubber and drink wine made by 100 penguins stomping on local grapes which have been adapted to our tundra-like conditions.
Ryan Reynolds, I knew it.
Ryan Reynolds and William Shatner often get very drunk and lame out, end quote. I should have known.
I knew that would happen. Everyone laughed when I talked about the secret Canadian meeting. So who's laughing now? Ha! 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 It's me.
Just you as always, yes. Well, now it's confirmed. Thanks, Vince. Mm-hmm. Val Coons, who just happens to be director extraordinaire of the second best podcast in the world, Cue Footsteps, wrote, quote, I have to confess, I had to look him up because I didn't recognize the name.
Sorry, Mr. Cera.
I also have to confess that after looking at his impressive history, that I've only seen two of his movies, and I love both and his roles in them. The first is the Lego Batman movie, which is freaking hilarious, and the second is Barbie, end quote. Mm. Well, both good choices, and see our entire episodes on Barbie and our entire special on Batman. Thanks, Val. Macman wrote, K. Cera Cera. Never seen any of his work, but maybe you can do something with my clever answer, which was intended as Quadlibet, whatever. We looked it up, and we still don't know what he meant, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Continuing.
Stop using hard words.
With cues. I have seen nothing that is listed on his Wikipedia page, oops. But by definition, if I didn't notice him, I didn't notice his performance, and whatever I saw is not a favorite. Anyway, I will check him out at some point once I learn what his most popular performance actually is, end quote. Well, can't argue with that. Thanks, Dave.
Yeah.
Roland Hardy simply wrote, quote, Molly's Game, end quote. Oh, didn't know that one. Thanks, Roland.
I know the movie, didn't see it, didn't know he was in it.
It actually sounds kind of interesting. It's about a high-level celebrity
poker game,
poker game that gets raided by the FBI, and he plays like one of the leading roles. But Keith Wright, aforementioned suggester of this week's film, said, quote, his work on Arrested Development, Zoxo, end quote, Well, Zoxo to you too, Keith.
I think that's XOXO.
Oh, yeah, sure. Like, you know everything. You didn't know what quaddle bet was.
Neither did you.
Well, yeah, but that's a given. Adam Mark, who never disappoints, posted, quote, gotta be Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, 2008. It's a wonderful meandering story of one day and night where some New Jersey high schoolers go into Manhattan to find an elusive band rumored to be performing in Alphabet City. Sarah plays the male lead and is given some amazing dialogue that draws upon his strengths. Side note, what strengths? End side note. Some amazing scenes of great cinematography. Nick and Nora having sex off-screen in an abandoned recording studio, the only indications of their lovemaking being the sensors and needles in the recording console picking up the noise. Drunk friend passed out in the backseat of a locked car with friends trying to entice her to unlock the door as playful music jumps about in the background like an irreverent fairy. An impromptu discussion with some roadies and musicians about how the most erotic, most powerful act of love ever is holding someone's hand. This is why they think the Beatles are, well, unbeatable. Unbeatable.
And on unbeatable?
Unbeatable. A wonderful movie and a wonderful performance. It's a crime it did not win any major awards, end quote. You know, I really ought to watch that at some point. Thanks, Adam.
Mm.
Have you seen it?
I have. It's charming. I don't know how great it is. It seems like it should be better than it actually is.
Adam it says also it's feels great. Like it's a, therefore, it's great.
It seems like it's a couple of movies that couldn't quite decide which one to be.
It is great. I am great.
Yes, you will not destroy M5.
Oh, Apple, you really better be looking forward to the future there.
Really, 2 years from now, we're going to have so much fun.
Skip the M5. Just do yourself a favor. Skip the M5.
Go to M6.
Yeah. Chrissy Becker-Krenitsky's answer was, quote, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, end quote. Indeed. Thanks, Chrissy. Reflecting that answer was Steve Harvey, who said, quote, for me, it's definitely Scott Pilgrim, one of my favorite modern movies, end quote. Thanks, Steve. Well, Max, you started this fight. How are you going to finish it?
Okay, I do love Scott Pilgrim. I think it's a lot of fun. I think he's good in that. My favorite, like, major role of his is actually last week's in Juno. I think that really suited him really well. The most fun is a tiny role he has in this movie called This Is the End, which is this weird, largely improvised apocalypse movie starring everybody.
Oh.
Where he is playing this Hollywood douchebag version of Michael Cera.
Oh.
Where he's like doing drugs and going after women and just fighting people. And he's hilarious because it's really kind of hard to picture Michael Cera doing that. And he kind of pulls it off.
See, now I kind of want to see him and Christopher Mintz-Plasse doing the same thing. Like, together, they're these horrible, horrible people. And they're out womanizing and drinking and somehow getting sex, which would be very... let's not be too mean.
Yeah, yeah. But what about you? What's your favorite in the Sarah-verse?
Don't even joke. It's very pale and it's very far away.
And very thin.
Like a lot of actors, he has his moments. And my two favorite are in Lego Batman, because his Robin is quite honestly one of his most energetic performances. That character is like the most unstoppable ray of sunshine in that film, which is a great juxtaposition to the person playing Batman who's desperately trying to stay dark and gritty. And if you haven't seen Lego Batman, I know you're probably thinking, oh, it's just this stupid movie for kids. Mm-hmm. It's for kids, sure, but it is so much fun.
It's so much fun. It's fun for everybody. Like, if you're a huge Batman fan, there's stuff in it for you. If you don't really know him, it doesn't matter.
No.
If you've ever watched a movie ever, there's something in it for you.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun. And it's actually touching at times.
Yeah, and it's just, I remember when he first pulls off his pants and he's got those sparkly underwear. Rip. And it's just like...
Yeah, I just like the way every time he does it, he yells, rip!
And last week's film, like you, Juno, I think he did an excellent job in Juno. Yeah. We like his character. Yes, he's a nerdy nobody, sort of, but, you know, he can run, which... most nerds can't.
And he has a good heart, and he immediately wants to do the right thing. You were the one who pointed out last week, when Juno tells him she's pregnant, his first line is, what are we going to do? Not what are you going to do, it's what are we going to do?
Yeah, and we kid, but I think that he actually has some really solid performances, and you wouldn't want him to play Superman or like James Bond or Lex Luthor. But then again, there's lots of other actors you wouldn't want to do that either. So, you know, all in good fun for us anyway.
Like Jesse Eisenberg.
Yeah, I'm evil because I'm bald now, which to be fair is canon. Curse you, Batman, for removing my hair. I shall never destroy let you everything. Yes, folks, that is in fact the origin of Lex Luthor. Look it up. Anyway, that's all well and good. Now that we have your attention, we'd really like to know what your favorite performance by Samuel Jackson is.
We really do.
Yeah, because...
Wow. Talk about an embarrassment of riches. I mean, this guy's been in, I think, let me check, 475 million movies.
You know what's really weird is he showed up in one of my the Christmas movies my parents used to take when I was a kid. It's so weird. I don't know how he got in there.
I don't know. I think he was in a Charlie Chaplin movie.
So yeah, so tell us in the usual ways, which we'll give you at the end of the show, though you all seem to really like Facebook. Traditionally, we'd now go on to trivia. Instead, we have a new segment that's called Trivia. Enjoy.
Oh, you got me. The facts.
Budget, $6.2 million. Oh, that's a cheap joint.
Yeah.
Take, $37.3 million. That's a damn good return.
Nice.
We chose this film because it didn't win the Best Picture Oscar. Well, it wasn't even nominated. And that bothered Kim Basinger, among other people, or Basinger, depending how you pronounce it.
If it bothered Kim Basinger.
Well, thing is, she was the announcer for the Best Picture nominees that year. She chose to go off script and read instead, quote, "We've got five great films here, and they're great for one reason, because they tell the truth. But there is one film missing from this list that deserves to be on it, because ironically, it might tell the biggest truth of all, and that's Do the Right Thing," end quote.
Wow, good for Kim.
For those who are wondering, the five films nominated that year were Born on the 4th of July, Dead Poets Society, Field of Dreams, My Left Foot, and That Which Won, Driving Miss Daisy, and we will get back to that one. The dialogue between the three men under the umbrella was all improvised. So was the scene between Sal and Pino, at least after Smiley showed up at the window. The chemistry between the characters of DeMayer and Mother-Sister wasn't something just worked up between actors. No. The pair were married in real life and often performed each other. And Ossie they are Davis so darling. When she finally like is willing to accept him, although why she does, I don't know. But
what I ever do to you? You a drunk fool. Besides that.
Radio Raheem is wearing gold rings, which spell out love and hate. This was a reference to one of Spike Lee's favorite movies, Night of the Hunter. The character
See our entire episode on Night of the Hunter.
I had that in my note if you'd let me get to it.
Never!
I'm hosting. You need to sit there and be quiet. Let me do the entire show by myself.
Okay, bye.
Yay, it worked. Come on, Bumpy. It's party time.
I'm not here. Totally gone.
Yeah. Anyway, the character played by Robert Mitchum in that film had those words tattooed on his fingers. See our entire episode on Night of the Hunter. Don't write this stuff for nothing. Rosie Perez was cast because of a butt competition at Spike Lee's birthday party.
Oh, dear.
Depending on who you ask, the contest was either spontaneous but started to get dangerous when Perez started dancing atop a speaker and Lee tried to urge her down before she got hurt. Or Lee started the contest himself. You can guess whose version is which. Either way, he tried to cast her as Mookie's girlfriend on the spot, though Perez, who didn't know him, thought he was just hitting on her. Who knows? He might have been.
This was her first actual movie. I think she'd been in a music video before this.
Oh, and she comes out screaming.
Oh, boy, does she.
Yeah. The reason people are chanting Howard Beach while Sal's famous pizzeria burns is because the movie was based on a similar incident that happened for real in the New York City neighborhood of Howard Beach. That aggressive dance number that opens the movie was inspired by Anne Margaret's opening to Bye Bye Birdie. Although I'm going to guess
was a lot better. That I would not have gotten. Okay. Yeah.
The character of Smiley was not even originally in the script. He only came about because his actor, Roger Gwenvuer Smith, approached Spike Lee asking for a part. And pardon for my mispronunciation. Barack and Michelle Obama's first date was to go see this movie. They were also going to go see Driving Miss Daisy that night, but didn't. Spike Lee jokes that if they had, they might not have got married. Paramount was the original distributor for this movie, but they wanted to water down the ending, fearing it was too incendiary. See what I did there?
As it were. Nice.
Yeah. Lee refused, and Universal took it up instead. He actually got a lot of support there. Originally, they were supposed to release it in July, and everyone was like, could we not release this in the summer, please? Could we release it in the fall? And even Spike Lee apparently was like, you know, if you have to, I get it. And the guy who was representing the film said, nope, we said July, it's going out in July.
So, wow. Good for him.
Yeah, some of the only support that film got. Oh, we'll get back to that. Sal's Pizzeria did not exist. The entire building was a set built on a vacant lot. What was left of it was torn down when the movie was over. F-bomb count, 240. Is that a new
record? That's all? I thought it was more.
Yeah, well, this movie netted Danny Aiello his only Oscar nod.
Oh.
Uncommonly, this movie was actually shot in Brooklyn.
Oh, wow. All right.
So not Vancouver or, you know, one of the other places, Toronto.
Or the back lot.
Yeah. And likely there's tons more. Mac, do you got anything?
The only thing that I kind of noticed, and it's a throwaway, but the guy who runs his bike over Bugganout's shoes, that's Jack Wolf. And his big thing was he was the lead in Hair.
Oh.
He plays Claude.
Man.
Yeah.
And he still looks reasonably youngish.
Yeah, if you look closely, I mean, he's much scruffier looking in this, but you can still see it. Hmm. Also, Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee, they weren't just married. These guys were major civil rights activists. They were coordinators on the March on Washington. They were huge in the African-American community. Not to mention, did a bunch of movies together and a lot of plays.
And they're darling.
They are adorable. And did you recognize... Well, we'll get this when we get to the cast.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's just move on to the plot.
Yep.
It's going to be a hot day in Brooklyn, and you can tell because radio DJ Love Daddy is telling you that first thing in the morning. Mookie, pizza delivery boy, wakes his sister and makes his way through the neighborhood, greeting all on his way to his job at Sal's famous pizzeria. It's an odd Italian-American-owned business in a predominantly black neighborhood. But who doesn't like pizza? What follows isn't so much a linear story as it is us checking in on various parts of the area, like hearing the wisdom of the three men who sit on the corner, the rounds as made by the self-proclaimed Da Mayor, hearing the blasted music of Public Enemy by Radio Rahim, call-outs by Mother Sister, a sort of godmother of the neighborhood, Mookie's girlfriend and mother of his son, Tina, the arguments between the members of Sal's family, and not least, the dissatisfaction of one Buggin' Out, who notices for the first time in his life that the wall of fame in Sal's famous pizzeria only has Italian-Americans on it. He raises a fuss and is thrown out, though his friend Mookie tries to smooth things over. As the heat rises, there are temper flares here and there, though it's mostly all a bunch of strutting and not much of any real substance. Until the sun goes down. Buggin' Out has been trying to organize people to stop eating at Sal's until there are some black people's photos put on the wall of fame. Most aren't interested, but he finally finds an ally in Radio Rahim, and that's enough. Though it's after closing, a few people want a slice, and Mookie convinces Sal to sell them all just one last slice. Then Radio Rahim and Buggin' Out come in, the radio blasting. Rahim refuses to turn it off, Buggin' Out says they won't leave until there are black people on the Wall of Fame, and finally, that spark ignites the fire we've all been expecting. Sal takes out his baseball bat and smashes Rahim's radio. The neighborhood erupts with pent-up frustration, a lot of it having nothing to do with anything, some of it being seated in very real emotions. The cops show up and things take a nasty turn. Buggin' Out is arrested and the cops are trying to subdue Rahim but end up killing him. They just manage to drive out before the assembled folks, led by Mookie, descend on the pizzeria, trash it, set fire to it, and watch it burn. The next morning, people try to pull themselves back together, and there's even a bit of hope. The end.
The film.
Yeah. That was, you know, it's funny for a film that in a way a lot of nothing happens, it was really hard to encapsulate.
I believe it.
So had you seen this when it came out?
I did. I saw it the year it came out.
Yeah, I did not. I will admit, I'll be fully open. This is my first Spike Lee film. I know that's a travesty. Okay. No. It's difficult for me to understand the culture. That's not an excuse for not trying, so I don't really have one, but I just wanted to be open. This is my first Spike Lee film.
That's cool.
And I'm glad this again was suggested by Keith Wright, at least one of our poll question answers. I don't know if he actually listens to the show. I'm guessing most people who answer the question don't, but that's okay. So
they should be ashamed of themselves.
I want to start off because this is an ensemble cast, and we could go crazy. Mm-hmm. I want to start off just saying there's no bad performances in this.
Everyone in this is amazing.
Do we want
to? And they're all believable. They're all real.
I guess I don't want to leave anybody out, but we can't go crazy here. So maybe we can just sort of narrow things down when we talk about each person. He's listed first. I don't want to talk about, I guess it's alphabetical, but let's start with Spike Lee.
Yeah.
Now, as a director and producer, writer. That's one thing. Here he is as an actor. Mm-hmm. I want to say that there's not a weak performance in this film, but his is a little bit detached. And I think I understand why, but what do you think?
I think he's doing that on purpose.
Why?
I think because he's trying, the character Mookie as somebody says to him, I think Tina says to him, you got to get a life, Mookie, because the one you got ain't working. And I think he knows that. And he's just trying to navigate his way in what he knows is a pretty explosive situation.
Yeah. I think that it's because by nature, Mookie is something of a peacemaker. And we see him do this throughout the film. And because of that, that can have the appearance of being a little wishy-washy or a little bit less strong of a character. But of course, that all changes at the end of the film. So initially, I was like, I don't know if I think much of him as an actor. And then as I thought more about it, it's like, no, I think that that's the character trying his best to get everyone to, and everybody knows Mookie, and a lot of people come to Mookie. So that's my guess. I will say that his relationship with his sister, as played by his sister, Joey Lee, is, how to put this, interesting.
Yes, considering he climbs on top of her in the first scene.
Yeah, we're not initially sure who they are until finally somebody says, you don't have to be the big brother. And I'm like, certainly not like that, but... I guess it's just because they only have one bedroom in the house or whatever. Yeah. But Ossie Davis and let's go ahead and do Davis and Ruby Dee. We already said they're adorable. Yep.
They are so cute, and they have, even though the mayor is kind of supposed to be a pathetic figure because he's an old drunk.
Yeah,
he has gravitas. Yeah. They both do. They have real presence, and you can tell at least some people in the neighborhood will listen to them.
Yeah.
I mean, he's clearly more of a figure of mockery to a lot of them.
Well, and he has
the mother's sister is much more, respected.
Well, he gets that great scene where there's a bunch of young guys who just come up and start throwing trash at him. Not literally,
just going off
because they just speak at him. Yeah. And it's a really interesting scene because there's no clear winner. On the one hand, he comes off saying, who are you to judge me? You know nothing about me. You know nothing about what I've done. Mm-hmm. And then the youngest leader of this group there is basically saying, yeah, well, that doesn't count for anything. And the stuff you're telling us is something I wouldn't do. It starts, you have no spine, blah, 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 blah.
I don't want to know your pain.
Yeah, I don't want to. But on the one hand, he's kind of right, because what do we've got? We've got DeMayor, who is just this guy calling himself the mayor and spouting off platitudes and, quite honestly, drinking through most of the day. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, who knows what he saw, And then who's this guy to come tell him, you should do this, or you should do that, or you should shut up? You're a kid. What do you know? You've been through what everyone else in this neighborhood's been through, probably. But again, you're not wrong either. So it's a really neat scene because it doesn't have a conclusion.
Yeah, but the best scenes for them, I think, are when they're talking to each other.
Oh, my God. When you can see, she is this iceberg of I'm not changing my mind. I'm not changing my mind. And then when he buys her flowers, there's just this whole look of disgust. And then this tiny little look of, kind of like flowers. No, I'm not going to change my mind. And she just slowly melts, not because of the heat, but it is really charming. And
it is.
When they end up together, there is this real comfort between them. And we don't know why she's like the word of wisdom on the street, but everyone believes she is.
Yeah, and you can believe it. You're looking at her performance and listening to her, it's like, yeah, of course they treat her that way.
We have a few other... We have the three guys on the corner who I think are all enjoyable for different reasons. Sweet Dick Willie, I wish that wasn't his name, but it was.
ML and Coconut Eddie.
Coconut Sid.
Sid, excuse me.
Yeah, and they're all fun. I think that they're just color there. You know, they're just meant to liven things up a bit.
Literally, yes. Yeah, they are the voice of the neighborhood. They're the voice of the older generation.
Yeah.
They're the ones who are like, I can't believe what's happening. Oh, can you believe this? Yeah, you could go to any neighborhood of any ethnic or national background. There will be three guys like that sitting around talking.
Yeah. Three kids on Bike Man.
Three kids, pretty much. And how about Bill Nunn as Radio Raheem?
Well, and I'm sitting there like, why do I know this face? Why do I know this face? It's like, because he was in Sister Act and he played the cop and he was in this and that. And
he was also in the Spider-Man movies as twice. Robbie Robertson.
Yeah. So it's like, oh, okay, now I know who Radio, because he's obviously a lot
he's
younger.
He's done a ton.
He doesn't have a lot to do.
No, but he has presence.
Yeah, he really does. In a in an openly uncredited role, his credit doesn't show up till the end. We have Samuel Jackson as Mr. Senior Love Daddy, who is okay. Let's just get this out of the way. He's kind of like the DJ from the Warriors,
a little bit. Except he's also kind of the Greek chorus. He's the one, and he's also tries to be the voice of reason.
One of them.
There's that sequence which I remember. Well, the first time when I saw it, it really caught me by surprise. When suddenly the camera just—I forget—I think it starts off with Mookie looking into the camera and just unleashing this stream of anti-Italian invective, and then they go to John Turturro, who's just spouting out all this anti-black stuff, and they just go around to all these characters, all of them looking into the camera like the camera's just inside their head and looking at the worst part of them, and it's. Mr. Senior Daddy Love Daddy, who just says, stop!
Yeah.
Like, it's as if he can see that.
Yeah.
He can see what's in there, and he's the voice, in a way, of the audience or the director or someone. He's almost a supernatural figure.
Kind of. In a way, it's not a big role, but it's an important role. I like your idea that the sort of the Greek chorus, or almost not a narrator, but also
no, he's not a narrator. But
the fourth wall. I was going to bring this up later because we usually do that when we talk about the film. Usually, fourth wall is used a very different way. I actually didn't find it was so strange because usually that it breaks the narrative, and usually it's done to break the narrative. And for me, in this case, even though it's technically the exact same way that people use fourth wall breaking, to me it didn't break the narrative. It actually felt more like we were getting inside the character, and this was their moment where they got to be utterly truthful about who they were.
I think the big difference is often a fourth wall break is the character addressing the audience.
Yeah.
This was just their inner voice.
Yeah.
This was just them addressing themselves or addressing their worst nature coming out.
And I don't know how Lee did it, because it's not shot really any different. It must be the writing. And I'll get to this later, but this is as much a writer's movie as was last week's.
Woo-hoo. Oh, yeah.
It just doesn't feel like they're talking to the audience. They're looking at us, but they're not talking to us. They're deaf, like you just said, it's their inner voice. So,
you know what I think the big difference is? It's like the audience is breaking the fourth wall, not the characters.
What do you mean?
We're looking in. They're not breaking the wall and looking out at us. We're breaking in and the director is opening a crack in the wall and letting us see into them.
That's
directly.
That's incredibly deft for what I think is his second movie.
Yeah.
So
it really is.
It was something that struck me at first, and then I realized that I was totally different, even though it was the same, and I was really taken by it. Joey Lee as Jade, his sister. Does a perfectly fine job. Her relationship.
She doesn't have a lot to do.
Well, yeah, but when she starts having a relationship with Sal, that's
weird. A little weird.
Yeah,
but I don't know. I thought Mookie got that wrong. I thought it was a little more of like a father figure. At least that's how I think she saw it. I'm not sure how Sal saw it.
I don't know. I think that Sal was using that as the cover, but that wasn't how he would like it to be.
Maybe.
But we'll get back. I want to see if we miss. Rosie Perez. She starts off the film just like the most aggressive dancing I have ever seen.
It's amazing. It's incredibly hot and incredibly angry at the same time. Because she's dancing around in three different outfits, very sexualized. Very powerful, and the rage that's coming across, which is perfect, it's matched perfectly to Public Enemy's Fight the Power.
Well, and I love the images of her as a boxer with that, because I don't think I've ever seen choreography that took advantage of something athletic like that and really went with it without it making look like dancing. Like, it still it was still kind of both.
It looks like she could hurt you, yes.
But then when she shows up as a character, ooh, you thought it was going to get hot outside. Ooh.
Hamana.
Well, no, I didn't even mean that. I mean, just mean she is a powerhouse.
Oh, like, yeah. No, she does not let Mookie get away with anything. Well, kinda. She obviously has a soft spot for him. She has a weakness for him. But she calls him out on everything.
And I think she actually wants him to sweet talk her into things. Mm. And she just wants the attention. She's like, needs his attention.
Well, that's the thing. He's never around. She just wants him to be around her and their son.
Yeah. And which is fair. And Mookie, of course, is trying to make money. Although, I gotta say, does anybody actually get their pizza? Because
we actually see at least one scene where, and it's odd because he's in the background,
yeah,
delivering a pizza. We don't see to who. It's like the actual pizza getting to someone is incidental
to him and the film.
Yeah.
I gotta say though, he's doing pretty good, $2.50 a week.
That's not bad for 1989.
Not in a little, you know, and tips.
It's not great. It's like $12,000 a year. That's ain't much.
Yeah, but you know, for a pizza store, I thought that was quite a lot, but whatever. Smiley was an interesting addition, and at first I wasn't quite sure what he was doing there, but I want to say that when he gets angry at the end of the film, it's a whole other level of... I almost think that it was both him and Mookie coming unhinged finally that really threw the crowd.
They hit a breaking point. They both do. And that's, yeah, I think that's what pushes everybody over the edge.
Yeah.
Oh, and did you catch who bugging out was?
I didn't recognize him, no.
That's Giancarlo Esposito.
Yeah,
who is in everything now. He is the villain in everything. He's the bad guy in The Boys. He was the bad guy in The Mandalorian.
Oh, that's right.
Yes, he's everywhere now.
Well, and
he's about 15 in this movie.
Well, and he's also half Italian, so... Yeah, I think it's his father who's Italian-American.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and he is bugging out. I think he both is a character, but he's also representing
just unfocused rage. Just the
Of an entire generation, right? Yeah. The people have just dealt with this and said, "We're enough. We're done."
And he's kind of the angry young man,
and he's one of the people that because we know that something's going to happen. Even if you know nothing about this film, I knew nothing about this film. You know that somebody is going to lose it, and he is one of my top candidates. I was very surprised when it turned out to be somebody totally different, but it was him or maybe Radio Raheem were probably my two top candidates. And well, we should probably get to one of the actors who, as it turned out, was Danny Aiello.
Oh yeah.
He didn't want to take the part because he's like, they wanted it for De Niro, and De Niro didn't want to play a stereotypical Italian-American.
Oh.
But,
okay, well, that is kind of what Aiello is doing here, but he's stereotypical because he's believable.
Yeah, it's totally authentic to me. And he does a great job. It's kind of sad. He does a great job in lots of films, including one of my favorite films, Hudson Hawk.
Ah, yes. That's right. Tommy Two-Tone. Five-Tone, excuse me.
See our entire episode on Hudson Hawk. I think he does a great job. I think it's really sad that he is the only Oscar-nominated actor for this film. And this
that is a real shame.
Only nod. Yeah, let's have a film of predominantly black people and just nominate the white guy. We'll get back to that. But he does a fine job. I believe I love the fact that the character comes off as very hard-nosed and blustery, and then we get that one scene with him when he's actually happy. And he's like, you know what? Today was a good day. This is a good day. And you know what?
I'm going to give this... you're like a son to me.
Yeah. And you believe him. You think that he actually, even though if he knew how much Mookie was doing while delivering pizza, you know, it's actually, you get to see different sides of him. But of course, that's in comparison to two of his sons. John Turturro plays one of them, who is, what a thankless part. It's like, hey, we need you to be like the all-in-out white bigot in an all-black film.
Also need to be angry as hell in every single scene. I will say, it's nice to see John Turturro actually portraying some of his genuine ethnic roots. I mean, we've seen him play Jewish. We've seen him play Latinx. We've seen him play Palestinian. Finally, he's playing Italian.
But let's face it, his best line ever was, "I'm underneath the robot's scrotum."
No, it isn't. It's not.
I think it totally is.
I think, don't mess with the Jesus.
He was actually, I like that one. It's either him or Bugging Out, I think, are my top like contenders for who's going to lose it first.
These are the guys who are going to be the fuse, yeah.
And he is just gets angrier and angrier as the film goes on. And of course, the more we learn about him, the less we like him.
Yeah, it's also, there's something kind of sad about him. Because even his brother, when Vito is saying, when Pino is talking about how you can't trust black people and they'll always shove a spear in your back, and Vito says, "How do you know this?"
Yeah.
And he just, "I know," which is the cry of every bigot.
Yeah. Well, later it will become, "I know because I read it on the internet." But
Yeah, exactly. And they told me on 8chan.
In a way, you can't understand it because they've been making their living all their lives in this black neighborhood. And you listen to listen to the black people when Bugging Out is trying to get them to all put a ban on the pizzeria. Yeah, and they're all like, "You kidding? I love his pizza. I've been eating it forever." And
they said, "I grew up on his food." He says that too. "They grew up on my food."
Well, and Sal is proud of that. He's like, "Look, I'm proud of being part of this community. These are people I've watched grow up, and I've watched them grow up partially eating my food." And that's when you finally, when all the bluster is blown away for a moment, and you get to see, it's not a fourth wall breaking scene for Sal, but it's us getting to see what a weakness. It's a weakness. We get to see his true feelings. But there's one other brother, and that's Vito, played by Richard Dedson. I'm going, "Where do I know him from? Where do I know him from?" Hey. I was like, "Oh, it's from Ferris Bueller."
Relax, man. I'm a professional.
Yeah, totally unrecognizable there, but...
Yep.
And you feel for Vito because Vito likes the neighborhood. He really likes Mookie. And Mookie is basically saying, "You need to stand up to your brother because he's a jerk."
But, and he's like, he seems to be of the three the least racist.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't seem to even understand the racism.
Yeah. So strong performances and interesting viewpoints all around in this film. Although I'm not saying I liked it, just, you know, there's some interesting directorial choices. One of the first ones is early on in the film, we see Mookie wake up and he's counting money. But the camera, it's almost like it's being held by somebody on tiptoe sneaking into the room. Mm-hmm. And I was waiting for something bad to happen. It was that one I thought was a very odd choice. But otherwise, there's actually some really artfully composed shots in this film.
Oh, absolutely.
The three men on the street corner are shot in front of this entirely red-painted wall. And it's like, there's a real sense of fine art here. Some of some of the other shots later will do the same thing. There's a real shot of almost a Renaissance-style composition in this film, which is really, really interesting. And I thought visually spoke very highly of Spike Lee's directorial choices.
Yeah, yep, definitely. It's incredible to look at. And it's surprising because it's such a claustrophobic set. I mean, it's
the neighborhood.
Yeah, it's the neighborhood. And it's not sweeping or grand, but there's an elegance about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like Spike Lee, he's from Brooklyn. He loves Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And you get that feeling. He's showing the bad stuff. But he's also showing the beauty and the elegance and the architecture and the fact that it is a real neighborhood. Everybody knows everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's part of the community. Some more than others. Some less than others.
Yeah. He also very deftly and quietly predicts global warming.
Kind of, yeah. He also predicts George Floyd.
Well, that's... Okay, so Michael Stewart is a name that pops up. And for those who don't know it, I know this actually from a Michelle Schacht song called Graffiti Limbo. And in the middle of the song, the song's about Michael Stewart. And in the middle of the song, she breaks in and just starts talking. She says, "Michael Stewart was a young black graffiti artist arrested while writing graffiti on a subway wall in New York City. While under arrest, Michael Stewart was strangled to death by 7 white transit cops." Those cops are back out on the street again, and she goes into the rest of the song. He predicts, or he really just reports on things that sadly have happened and have continued to happen, which is the worst part. It would be so nice if this film was like the tail end of racism, And
yeah, it would be nice if we could look back and go, God, things are so much better now.
Yeah. And we're going to come back to that, too, because there's something else waiting in the wings.
Some of the other little touches I liked the close-up of the newspaper headlines. And my favorite one, yes, it's hotter and muggier, and yes, you're going crazy. Like, thank you, that's the most honest headline.
Was it the Post?
I could have been.
Yeah, it sounded very Post-ish. One of the things also is that I thought that this film felt very much like a play.
Yeah, there's a lot of it is the dialogue, and a lot of it is there's a lot of two-person stuff. There's a lot of back-and-forth dialogue, two, maybe three people in a fairly closed set, you know, inside the pizza parlor, on a stoop.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Lots of stuff on the stoop. Do you know off the top of your head, do you know if Spike Lee's done anything with plays or done any stage stuff? I don't know. Yeah, I don't either.
I don't know if he's ever done any actual stagecraft like that.
But you could totally do this as a play.
You could. You really could.
You could actually, it might be really interesting to see. Not that it wasn't necessarily good, I can't say one or the other, as a movie. Uh-huh. Yeah, I know, right? I also got I'm waffling between Shakespearean and Chaucer-like feel to this. Little snapshots of like lots of different characters doing different things, but it all being part of a whole.
It's all part of they're all part of the same group.
Yeah.
And so much of it is also done with, I mean, as you say, the dialogue's very sharp. It's very much a writer's movie.
Oh, yeah.
But when there's that sequence where the police are driving by the three older men, the looks, there's no words. The way the older men look at the cops and the way the cops look back, it's chilling.
Yeah, it is.
Hate.
Especially because Mustache Cop is actually Danny Aiello's son.
Yes, he is.
And he is frightening.
He's disturbing.
Although, is it Mustache Cop? No, it is the Mustache Cop. The other one kind of looks like Dennis Franz, but, you know.
A little bit, yeah.
And the sad thing is what does that guy say? He mouths, or we barely hear him say, what a waste. And it's like, what a waste of what? Apparently it's a Sunday, right? So nobody's at work. They're sitting out and talking. Why is that a waste? No. Like a waste of what?
No idea.
I'm guessing all three of them are professional or are retired, having been professional. Because they're dressed well, they don't get moist because it gets hot.
But it's 100 degrees,
but like,
and they're in the city, and that's awful. It's like being inside a microwave.
Yeah, well, that's why you sit and go, oh, we'll get some relief when the sun goes down. No, that's when the Easy Bake Oven comes on.
yeah, that's when you realize all the concrete's been heated up and is now radiating the heat everywhere.
One of the things I'd also like to point out is that Spike Lee is very even-handed in this film. It would be really easy to just go, rotten white people, they ruin everything.
Yeah.
He's not doing that at all.
No, the three guys we were just talking about, one of them's going off on the Korean grocer. And his complaint is, he's been here a year and he's got a shop. Why don't we? And he says, it's because we're black. And the other guy says, no, man, it's because you don't do anything.
Yeah. Well, and what was there before? Nothing. It was boarded up as long as they could remember.
So, and he's upset because it isn't boarded up anymore. No, there's plenty of unpleasantness to go around, but a lot of it, it's the situation that the black neighborhood finds itself in. That is very different than the white neighborhood.
Well, and there's this really great scene at the end where they're ripping apart the pizzeria, and they go. Some of them go towards the Korean market, and the man who runs it basically convinces them that we're the same. And they're like, we're not the same. I'm black and you're Korean. At least they know he's Korean. I don't even know if he's Korean. But he's basically like, no, I'm getting stomped on just like you are. You don't accept me any more than you're accepted. And he's able, with fairly broken English, to tell them it is the same. And I'm part of the community. And they accept him, which is actually really nice.
Almost. That always makes me sad. He's holding out his hand. He's offering to shake hands, and they just turn their backs on him. But they don't attack him or his store, so something got through there.
Well, and I think that the spotlight here isn't specifically on the white's treatments of black. It's literally on human beings' treatment of each other and how anybody can easily fall into this trap. Now, that being said, it is most predominantly, especially when it comes to white cops in Brooklyn at this time. I can't say whether that's still true. I won't say if it's true because It's true. oh, I just said it.
Yeah, you did. Don't hear anybody disagreeing with you.
No, not all. There's just you. It is. That is specifically bad, but it is obvious that there is room for blame on all fronts. It's just that, unfortunately, most of the blame and most of the bad treatment comes from one direction. And
yeah.
But he could easily have just said, this is us being treated like crap by white people, and he wouldn't be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't do that. He actually says, look, this can happen to anybody. And it is mostly happening to us, but look how we're treating the Koreans, and look how so on and so forth. Even the Koreans are treating the black people in the neighborhood that they set up a shop. Like, you know, they're, mm-hmm. they show their racism too. So it's, yeah.
Yeah.
When that part hits you at the end of the film, it hits hard.
It does.
Speaking of hitting hard, there is one scene in particular that Spike Lee's like, no, I'm not turning the camera. This is not happening off screen. I am not going to in any way flinch. And that's when we watch Radio Raheem getting strangled. And if doesn't make you angry, something's wrong.
That is such a hard scene to watch.
Yes.
Yeah, it's absolutely enraging because it's real. You know it happens. It's still happening. They're trying to subdue him, and they choke him to death. And one of them, you know, even one of the cops is yelling at him, going, let him go. It's enough. And the guy's just furious, and he won't stop.
Yeah.
He won't stop until he kills him. And it's horrific.
It is. And there's talk about, I've read things, articles and stuff, about how there is a point where it is part of fight or flight, but you get into this rage and your vision literally narrows so that you're only seeing a tiny little thing, and your brain is set on it. Basically, the lizard brain leaps up and goes, you're doing this, that's all you're doing. This does not excuse the behavior at all, but
no, and it doesn't excuse the other cops. They could have stopped him,
right? And they
they just don't.
Hey, no, don't do that. That's bad.
Not nice. Yeah,
which is kind of what ends up happening. And it is incredibly sad, and it is incredibly brutal, and it is very much against the feeling of most of the rest of the film, and at least in my opinion, is very necessary, which is sad, but what did you think?
It's one of the hardest scenes there is to watch.
Yeah.
And Radio Raheem, what is his great crime? He plays his music loud. Big deal. Good Lord.
Well, so here's one of the things I did want to talk about, and this is partially with it being a writer's film, and oh boy, is it a writer's film. And it's interesting because it's such a writer's film in a very different way than Juno was. Everybody in here, it's like everyone is strutting their stuff. Everyone has to talk big. Everyone has to be, you know, it's about this, that, and the other thing, when it doesn't necessarily have to be about that, this, that, or the other thing. That's why I think when he breaks the fourth wall, it's so important, because we actually get to hear what's really being said. It's hot. I don't know about you. I hate being hot. That is part of it.
Oh, yeah. And it's easy. There's always more violence and more crime when it's hot.
It is also just people. One of the things people still do, everybody does, is they feel the need to carve out their territory. And anybody feels like it's encroaching on it in any way, that starts getting people bubbled up. And that's one of the only reasons that we're able to get over it is with quote unquote civilization, is recognizing that when that's happening, it's not a threat.
And the other problem is there's always people who will egg things on.
Mm-hmm.
That whole sequence with the white guy with the bicycle who scrapes up Bugging Out's shoes, and Bugging Out is screaming at him and, you know, fronting basically, telling him he's going to kick his ass. And other sort of mini Greek chorus of those other four guys are just egging him on and saying, yeah, man, look at that. And he said something about your mother, too. They're like, yeah, go back to Massachusetts.
wearing a Celtics jersey.
Yeah, and I was like, I was born in Brooklyn. And they just all start shrieking. And see, there, it's much more of the kind of the male threat display, the I will puff out my chest feathers and thump.
I was thinking of the prairie chickens, too. It is.
Yeah,
it's like every rock and roll song is a prairie chicken dancing around going, hey, hey, baby, hey, baby, hey, baby.
Yep. And there's a lot of that, especially in these small neighborhoods where everyone has to, like, And a lot of, it's very male.
Yes, it
it's
is.
Like, no, I've got to be, everyone should be afraid of me. Everyone should, you know, you don't want me mad at you because I'll tear you to pieces.
Yeah. Well, Sal does it. Vito does. Well, mm-hmm. Vito doesn't really do it. It really is
not
more
so
of
much,
Pino.
But Pino definitely does.
Vito, actually, Vito doesn't do it because that's why he's such a milksop.
Yeah, well.
But even to some extent, the Koreans do it because they start treating when people walk in and they're like, you know, sort of up and in their face, especially DeMayer. They're like, you know, mm-hmm. we're not gonna serve the beer that you buy from us and like so much. We've just decided we're not doing that one because you like it. And it's like, why do you need to do that?
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that the film is illustrating is that there are conditions where no matter what our intentions, we are pushed to a point that we don't realize that we've been overcome. In this case, mm-hmm. I think a lot of it has to do with the heat, but at some point, something was going to set this thing afire, and it does. And it was just surprised. Were you surprised when you first saw? I don't know if you could remember back. But were you surprised by who the person was who starts it all? Because I was.
I don't remember being particularly surprised because I thought it could have been anybody. Because the whole idea, the image of the heat is things are at a boil.
Yeah.
It's not just the weather; it's the whole situation. The whole place is simmering.
Yeah.
And just needs it to go up just a little. You mean Smiley?
Yeah. No. Yeah. The person who sets it off is Sal. We've actually seen that nice scene with Sal where he's like, you know what? I'm happy. This is a good life. Yeah. I'm going to give this to my sons. I like the community. And then
he attacks Radio Raheem's radio, which you do not do.
Well, it doesn't matter who it is. You know, there's stuff. And on the other hand, you might also say, what right does Radio Raheem have coming into this business and inflicting his music on somebody? He doesn't. Mm-hmm. I want a question. We might get into trouble for this. Do you think Buggin' Out had a point? And if he did, could he have perhaps put it a different way?
I don't really think he did. This is standard in an Italian restaurant. They put Italians on the wall.
Yeah,
those are admit now. Yes, if Sal was a little more diplomatic, he could have put up a couple of other people. He could have put up a couple of people of color. That wouldn't have been that big a deal. But it is his store and his choice. And yeah, Buggin' Out is way too confrontational about it. He's just he immediately puts Sal's back up.
Right, and that's not the way to get anybody to do anything.
Mm.
I'm of the same opinion. It's like it's you wandering into somebody's place and telling them they need to do things your way. How would you feel if that Sal walked in, let's say Buggin' Out opens his own clothing store and Sal goes in for, I can't imagine what he would buy that Buggin' Out would sell, but let's say he does and says, you know, you should have pictures of Italian people on this because there's Italian people that work in this neighborhood. What? On the other hand, I also see Sal, if he was really that much wanting to be a part of the community, he could say, you know what? There are plenty of people in here that probably would be considered heroes. I should put somebody up.
Yeah.
Maybe even some of just Smiley's pictures.
It's not handled well. And I think Jade is the one who sort of sums it up when she's talking to Buggin' Out. And he's like, you know what? You're going to not keep it real? He says, yeah, I'm going to keep it real, but I want to do something positive.
Yeah.
I want to build. I don't want to, tear things down.
Right. And of course, well, we know where that goes. So,
yeah.
Yeah. But you know where else I know where it goes? This show. We have to get to that part we talk about, do we like the film? And more importantly, should maybe it have been even considered for a Best Picture?
The Finish.
So, Max.
You.
I got to get a t-shirt that just says So Max on it for no particular reason.
Yep.
Do you remember if you liked it the first time you saw it?
I do. I remember I felt about it pretty much the same way I did this time. I think it's an amazing film. It's really hard to watch.
I don't think it's hard to watch until the end.
The problem is I think the second time it was more so because I know what's coming.
Right.
And I don't want to see it again. I don't want to see poor Radio Raheem die. And yeah, I think this is an incredibly powerful and very effective movie, and I think what it gets across matters, and I think it's done in a really good way.
Yeah.
And what about you? You hadn't seen it when it came out. Is this the first time you saw it?
Not only that, but this is my first Spike Lee film. Never seen a Spike
That's
Lee
right.
film.
That's right. You said, okay, yep. Wow. How did it work for you?
It was really amazing. I think I really did not know what to expect. We did that series on Viola Davis, And there was a lot of black culture in those films that I honestly didn't understand. It's not my place to understand it. And it's not that film's place to, you know, describe everything so I get it. That's fine. I was worried that I wouldn't understand the film. I had absolutely no trouble understanding the film. What I really was pleasantly surprised by was the subtle touches, the artisticness of the film, the fact that it's very in your face, but there are still thoughts for how it's being done, the way the things like the fourth wall were broken. And the message, of course, is, you know, really the important thing, but also that even-handedness was something that didn't need to be there, but meant a whole lot because it was.
So, I think you said that you think it ends with hope. I'm not sure. I mean, when Mother, Sister, and DeMayer are talking, and he says, I hope the block's still standing, and she just looks at him and says, we're still standing. But then when the DJ is talking, and he said, there's no end in sight for this heat.
But there's that scene with Mookie going and talking with Sal. And part of me is like, wow, you got a lot of nerve.
Yeah.
You were the one that threw the barrel through a store and that started it being burned down and he's lost his livelihood. But the thing that's hopeful is that Sal actually talks to him.
Yeah.
Sal could easily just go
off on him.
No. Yep. And in a way, it almost feels like that Sal might maybe on a tiny measure understand what happened. Not
maybe
even eventually forgive it. I don't think there is no chance that Pino ever will.
No.
Vito, I don't know. I think Vito's torn because if it's his family, but it's also people that he really likes and respects. So that's why I think it's hopeful, because there's something between those two characters at the end and it's a little spark of respect. So yeah, I think it's an amazing film. Big question.
Yeah.
Do you think it should have been included? I mean, look at those films. Best Picture. We had Field of Dreams, white people. We have Driving Miss Daisy, white people. We have, you know, all those films. Do you really think this film should have been potentially?
I think it should have been. Should have been nominated. There's no question.
What a stupid
question. And Spike Lee should have been nominated for Best Director, because he just, especially considering that this is his first film.
Yeah.
His first major. Well, I think She Gotta Have It is the first one. But this is his second movie, and he knocks it out of the park.
Yeah.
The Academy, well, let's just say they're not known for their intestinal fortitude, and they don't like things that make them feel uncomfortable or feel bad, and any movies about racism have to show that, see, white people are okay, not all white people, see?
Yeah.
And,
You know, he only got nominated once for Best Director, Black Klansman.
Oh, yeah, for Black Klansman, which he lost to Green Book, for God's sake.
Yeah, we're going to...
Which is not a bad movie. I will say that now. It's a decent movie, but it's very much, you know, white savior movie. And
yeah, we're going to get
to that. See, we can just get along. Everyone would be... Wouldn't it be nice if everyone was nice?
Yeah, he won an honorary Oscar, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know what that's worth.
The 1990 Oscars were interesting. Do you remember a weird, odd occurrence from the 1989 Oscars?
Oh, was that the streaker?
No.
No.
It is you know it.
Okay.
I'll give you a hint. It's the reason that we are on the phone every year with the Oscars.
Oh, the Rob Lowe Snow White number.
Yeah.
Oh, dear God.
An incident that caused everybody watching the Oscars to sit up and go, what?
Yeah, that's why I was on the phone with Libby. She called me up. Okay, did I just have a stroke? Or did you see Rob Lowe and Snow White dancing also?
Yeah. So there was a specific movement, if you want to call it that. You can choose which definition of the word movement you want to make the 1990 show a lot better. So they tried to be more diverse in their nominations, but certain films were left out, such as Michael Moore's Roger and Me was not up for Best Documentary for some unknown reason. And, of course, Do the Right Thing. The latter was only nominated for two. Danny Aiello for Best Supporting White Actor, Actor, and Lee for Best Original Screenplay. It won neither. But let's talk about the film that won that year. Had you seen it when it came out?
Nope, I had never seen it.
Me either.
Just saw it yesterday.
How did you? What did you think of Driving Miss Daisy?
Okay, first off, I was ready to absolutely hate it because this is one of those movies that is, people point out, a movie that shouldn't have won Best Picture. And it's also pointed out as one of the famous examples of the magical Negro genre.
Sure.
Where you have the black character who really only exists to help the white character.
Well, it's also a white savior because she...
Yeah. Yeah, I gotta say, it's touching. And Morgan Freeman and Jessica Tandy are wonderful. They did a real... The performances are really good. Even Dan freaking Aykroyd is in it, and he does a nice job. And Patti LuPone, the Lady of Broadway, is in it.
Yeah.
She doesn't do much.
No.
But as a movie, it really sets my teeth on edge.
You know what was funny? I hadn't seen it either. I only saw it a couple days ago. I was way more uncomfortable watching Driving Miss Daisy. I was cringing through that film. I mean, they were just short of a yes, sir, no, sir. I mean, it was...
Oh, yeah. Now, Morgan Freeman, now, to be fair, this was 1948 Georgia. A lot of people did talk that way. But, yeah, I kept waiting for, lawsy, lawsy, this place is hated.
Yeah, I mean, it may have been 1948 America, but it was also 1989 America.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just cringed my way through the whole film. I found it really uncomfortable. Yes, yeah. Jessica Tandy does a wonderful job. Yes, Morgan Freeman... I honestly don't know how he feels about the performance, and that's the most important thing. To me, I was embarrassed. Morgan Freeman is, as good as he may have played the part, he is worth so much more. It was like, it felt to me like a big step backwards. It was just, I thought it was embarrassing. I was embarrassed to watch it alone.
I don't think it should have won. Honestly, even of some of the others that were nominated, Born on the 4th of July is a much more powerful movie.
Yeah.
And this, and I'm sorry, this movie handles both racism and friendship better than Driving Miss Daisy. I think it was a shame that Do the Right Thing wasn't nominated, and that it real shame it didn't win.
Well, here, I'll make the big question. If it had been included, if there were six nominees, I'm not going to remove anybody, if there were six nominees, which film do you think should have won Best Picture?
I think it should have been Do the Right Thing. Because they're supposed to reward innovation. They're supposed to reward taking chances and not just following formulas. Yeah. And we see that, well, I'm wrong.
Well, and often the Oscars will favor the up-and-comer, the independent filmmaker and stuff. But, of course, we know why they didn't favor Spike Lee.
Mm. Yeah, he makes people uncomfortable. He scared them.
Except, again, I was more uncomfortable watching Driving Miss Daisy.
Now, yeah, but it's very much a Hollywood movie.
I know.
It's much more Hollywood, and it's much safer and more comfortable.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is it doesn't challenge anything.
Nope.
And also, at least when depicting Jews, they picked those two well-known Jewish actors, Jessica Tandy and Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah. Members of the tribe, neither of them.
So they even whitewashed the white people in it.
Yeah.
I didn't know she was supposed to. I didn't know they were supposed to be Jewish until partway through the film, and she's mentioning temple. And did you see? I loved it. You know where she goes? She goes to the temple.
Yeah.
That's what it was called, the temple.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, really? It's not anyone, Solomon, anything?
Well, I figure in Atlanta at that time, it probably was the temple.
Yeah. And then, of course, we see that one scene where the temple's burned down, which is, of course, very frightening. But, of course, we have to see something where she is also like treated badly by society because she's, not saying the Jews don't go through crap. Please don't get that wrong. But, So that's our show on
that. I think that was a miscarriage of justice. Yeah. The fact that, no.
But we have a poll question we'd like you to answer, and that's a really easy one. It probably isn't.
No, it really isn't.
We'd really like to know what your favorite performance by Samuel Jackson is. We really want to know. And to let us know, you can email us directly at us@maxmikemovies.com. You can go to our website like Vince does. He's from Canada, you know. That's maxmikemovies.com, where all our episodes are put aside, so you can leave comments or reminisce or talk with people like Cheese Boy or whatever. Give us ideas for new shows or series or what have you. You can also go to Facebook, where we are, surprise, Max Mike Movies. Leave your comments there, which most people do. And if you like podcast apps, oh boy, have I got a deal for you, because we're on all of them. I think there's some that haven't been invented yet, and we're still on those as well. But we're just over halfway on this particular series of Didn't Win, didn't win. And we need another film that didn't win. Max, do you have a film that we're going to watch next week that didn't win?
I do. This one also not only didn't win, but wasn't nominated for Best Picture, although it was nominated for Best Director.
Oh, yes. That's always a bad sign. Somebody up there doesn't like me.
Yeah. And this is, of course, a lighthearted romp.
Oh.
Which, of course, starts off with the scene where we all say, "Seize the bone!"
Wait, no, actually, we
don't. We're not doing Jack the Giant Killer. Oh, we're actually doing 2001, A Space Oddity.
Odyssey,
right. Space Oddity was David Bowie. That doesn't make any sense.
Do you know off the top of your head what won that year?
Yes, I believe it was the musical Oliver.
Oh, see, that's the problem. They should have added songs to 2001.
Yes, that's it.
That would have changed everything.
Open up that pod bay door, Hal.
If you want to hear that and many songs like it, tune in next week for our episode on
Hal and I.
More like Hal and on, if you know what I mean. Tune in next week for 2001, A Space Odyssey.
This has been a co-production of The Voice of Max and The Movie Wrench.